We're going to have a question and answer session now, and we'll invite Alana Blass up. I guess we'll sit at the table. Does that make sense?
Correct me that if two parties agree to follow the decision of the New York State Court, they're allowed to do that, and then they come to Basin to enforce it. Is that accurate?
No, flip it around. The parties can agree on a choice of law. They can agree that New York law should govern their transaction or their relationship. But the case needs to be adjudicated by the Besdin. The Besdin would then apply New York law. Most likely we'd have, as a member of the panel, at least one lawyer who is familiar with New York law. And we would issue an arbitration decision, a PSOC, that incorporates New York law. Enforcement has to be obtained really in the secular courts. We don't have any enforcement powers. You'd have to go, if there's no compliance with the PSOC, then you'd have to go to secular court to enforce it, because only the secular courts have the sheriff to go and actually enforce it. But it's in that order. They'd have to come to the Besdin. The Besdin would sift through the facts, accept the evidence, analyze the facts and circumstances of the case, apply New York law, and we would issue a PSOC that would then be enforceable in the courts.
So once the Besdin is involved, then you're not violating the clause.
That's right, because ultimately the adjudication is done in the Besdin. That's right.
I see the sample arbitration provision. I think it would be fantastic to make it a custom on Jewish community, that anytime you have someone fix your plumber, Jewish plumber, then this should be signed off on by both parties.
I agree.
We agree.
Great. Okay. One question I had was as a choice of law provision. So if the plumber comes to my house and I saw him have a do a firm plumber, should I be adding some sort of choice of law provision? Should I be saying this is based on New Jersey law, this is based on the law? What should I put?
You're saying in your agreement with the plumber, if you have a written agreement with the plumber,
right,
you're free to contract however you want. You could write a contractual provision that says Jewish law should govern. You could write one that says New Jersey law should govern. The Besdin will do whatever the expectation of the parties is, whatever the parties had contracted to.
Okay. Any advice on this?
State law, wherever, I mean, assuming you live here, I think that state law would make sense as there is a body of law. Governing the expectations that a plumber would have and sort of the course of dealings that generally occurs.
But I wouldn't discourage you from choosing Jewish law either.
No, not at all.
We like Jewish law.
But you also have to see who you're dealing with. I mean, my plumber, I don't think I shouldn't say this as an attorney. How often? No, I live in Muncie. Everyone, all the plumbers are Jewish. But I don't think I signed that. I mean, major contracting, yes. But if it's a small plumbing issue, a lot of it is verbal. I think a lot of it depends where you live. The expectation in certain communities is that everything is brought to Basin. And the expectation in other communities is, you know, there is not that expectation.
Why among many Brooklyn, unfortunately, down 3 times a day, we said to say, oh, she was retainer, when we want to, you know, establish the courts. However, when something happens between two of them, the first thing you hear, in many cases, unfortunately, I believe, is that I'll see you in court, and they're not talking about the best. What I'm asking you is what can be done. For example, I don't think you could put someone in harem today. I'm not sure how that works. But if somebody knew that the Jewish community would ostracize this individual for going to secular court, for example, I had one case, I mean, I was involved with, related to one case, where they put a seerah up against somebody, dealing with a gun and a kid, the whole business. And they put the sign up in the shul. The seerah up against Chaim Yankel. Well, nobody knows who Chaim Yankel is. So I have to be involved a little bit in this case. I said, put a picture of Chaim Yankel on the seerah, like the wanted in the post office. Mm-hmm. You'd be surprised how fast there was a reaction to take it down. Because some cousin saw his picture there, you know what they got in the shul, you better get down, ran to the rabbi. So I'm saying there should be, I don't know whether it's a cherem or the community ostracizes someone who goes out and does this, and goes to secular court, which is against the Torah. But how many times do you hear that? I'll I'll see you in court. I'll see you in small claims court.
Right.
And both wind up, you know who makes the money on it? I can tell you the lawyers.
Right. But there are two answers. No, no.
I'm not against lawyers.
Besden does periodically, from time to time, issue seravin against people who refuse to answer Hazmana. We do that.
Issue this?
I'm sorry?
New York Times? Where do you put this?
We don't publicize it. We issue it to the parties. The parties are then free to enforce the seravin wherever they want. But it's then up to the community.
Well, the parties can... You know, first of all, I think part of this, that it, if you're looking sort of at the history, it's just the breakdown in what used to be the rabbinic authority and the fact that there is no united rabbinic authority like there was, you know, hundreds of years ago. That's a whole other topic. So if I put, you know, if we send it to the parties can go, if there's someone living in Bergenfield, to every shul with or without, they can supply a picture and have it hung up. How the rav of each individual shul is going to enforce that seiruv, or how the community reacts to someone, like you said, who does not give a get in a timely fashion to his wife, is really a communal issue, and it's something a little bit beyond what we can do. We can push as much as we can, and we can give out the seruv, but the party can take an ad in the New York Times, the Jewish Week, the Jewish Passion, whatever they want to do.
Well, the one case that worked, and the one I'm thinking of, was with some actually a publication here in New Jersey, threatened this lawyer, he happened to be a lawyer, the one who was married to this girl. Threatening to write the whole story up in this...
There are all sorts of avenues where you can get the word out. There's an important organization called ORA.
That's what did it.
There's an important organization called ORA, the Organization for Resolution of Aguna, who's taken a strong stance and really taken an active role in our communities to advance the plight of Aguna, to try to help out the situation, to publicize the seravin that we issue. That's made a real difference on the ground. The seravin that we issue actually have teeth, more so than they did 10 years ago because of the work of ORA.
Is it possible, or I find that in dealing with a lot of the issues of children and family issues, that a problem is that we cannot get temporary orders, that while a case is being heard in Basin, there was a desperation by either party, the husband or the wife, to have some temporary resolution, whether it's child support or visitation or custody or what's happening over the summer. And we look to the Beis Din for at least have either a temporary order saying what the visitation should be or a temporary order of support or something that happens in those months before you bring up the case and the final order.
We do issue interim decisions, and we have been more, and I think in the realm of child custody, as Rabbi Weissman said, in New Jersey, according to the Forza case, courts will enforce a well-reasoned arbitration decision with respect to child custody. So at least for this community, it really does make sense to come to Beis Din. But I think especially in that, where there's so many little minutiae that could... apply to different, you have many children and there are a lot of goings on. We do, we will convene a hearing, or if it's a small, you know, a smaller issue, we can convene a panel, but use hearings via written submissions, and then the Dayanim can send out questions, which we will then field. It doesn't necessarily have to be in person, but we will issue an interim decision prior to a final PSAC.
Yeah, we do it all the time in custody cases. We just did one a few weeks ago.
A few weeks.
I could tell, when it comes to child molestation cases, they should not be in Besden. They should be in court. We simply don't have the power to enforce anything. We don't have any criminal jurisdiction over criminal matters. Child molestation is, without a question, a criminal matter, and I don't know what a Besden could really do in that area. If we could, I'd be happy to help, but I don't think we have any power. The place to go is the police. There's no prohibition against going to the secular courts on a criminal matter, and especially where the safety of a child or the safety of any individual is in question. If there's an allegation of child molestation, you call the police. They're the ones who know how to investigate it. They're the ones who know how to prosecute it. I'll tell that to anyone who calls us and says that they have an issue for a Bez Din. I mean, I don't know how a Bez Din could help, really.
What about assault and battery?
So any criminal matter should be brought to the criminal authorities.
Even if he owes me money.
No, if you have a civil cause of action against someone, then we could handle that, sure. We could, if while the police are dealing with the guy, you want to sue him for civil remedies, we could do that. But that's not the bread and butter of what we do.
Under what circumstances, if you get a claim, comes into the base thing, you say, well, this is, what's your standard of review for a claim where you would say, well, all right, we're going to accept it or we're not going to accept it, we're going to make a defendant have to respond to it?
If it's a prima facie, logical, reasonable claim, I lent the guy $100 and he owes me $100 and here's a copy of the note, we'll send out Azman on that basis. If the claim is inherently irrational, we won't. We'll ask follow-up questions. Is that right?
Yeah, to that end, I would also say something that comes up a lot is what if the statute of limitations has expired in secular court and someone is trying to come into Beis Din to have it heard. Similarly, what if there's already been significant litigation in secular court? Plaintiff A brings defendant B to court, and for whatever reason, it could be he sees that he's losing. A year and a half later, he tries to bring him to Beis Din. Normally, we will send out a hazmana for an action that's been started in secular court to be brought into Beis Din. So then how do we deal with that? And generally, of course, if both parties in those cases would nonetheless want to come and hear it in Beis Din, we will hear it. But after investigating, if we send out a hazmana investigating, the statute has passed, we are not going to continue to along the process towards the Seiruv because the person is clearly using Beis Din in a way that shouldn't be used. Either he shouldn't have gone to secular court in the first place, or he should have done this within the statute of limitations. Anything you want to add?
Right, I agree. And just to clarify, in a situation where a case has been litigated to some extent, parties have appeared in front of a judge, there's been some amount of adjudication in secular court, we will not compel the parties to appear in front of Beis Din. Halacha is clear that once the secular court has dealt with a case, you can't later wake up and do tshuva and say, oh, I should have brought it to Beis Din when you see things aren't going your way. We won't.
That being said, there have been times where both parties have said enough. We spent enough money on lawyers. This is dragging. It's been a year and a half. We want to have it heard. And of course, we respect parties' wishes. If both parties then want to come in, they can even give us, all the discovery, which will then be given to the Dayanim. We will, of course, respect parties' wishes. But we're not going to compel someone to come.
If you sell your husband to a Beis Din of America, I say, you know what? I'll be more than happy to go to Beis Din. I don't trust your Beis Din. I'll go to a Chassidish Beis Din or a Chassidish Beis Din of Beis Din and say, I don't trust your Beis Din. I'll go to a Beis Din of America. And neither party will agree on a Beis Din. So what do you do in that situation?
So, first of all, that's why any good contract, right, the hallmark of a good contract is looking at the breakup clauses. What's going to happen? So, yes, you should pick a specific Beis Din, or, it doesn't have to be ours. We'd love it to be ours, but it doesn't have to be. But there is, and this is really the halachic concept of Zabla, that if two parties cannot agree on one specific Beis Din, so then what we can have a Zabla convene where one party picks Dayan X or Beis Din X, Dayan from Beis Din X, the other one picks Dayan Y, and together, those Dayanim will pick a third neutral party. That's usually done outside of our jurisdiction, meaning that our rules and procedures do not apply. We have had Zablas, not as many, but we have had Zablas where one will say, I will pick my Dayan, you pick your Dayan, but I'm only using these rules because most Batei Din do not have written, transparent rules and regulations. Some others might, I don't know, but we clearly do, and some people will only feel comfortable in that type of forum.
One thing that distinguishes Zabla in our view of the world from the way other Batei Din see it is that we insist that when you pick your Dayan, in a situation where the two parties can't agree on a particular Beis Din, we're the summoning Beis Din, and so we say, okay, name one arbitrator and then The plaintiff will name arbitrator, and the two will name a third. We insist that the arbitrators chosen are not toenim, are not people who function primarily professionally as advocates, as halachic advocates for their clients. The dayanim typically have to be dayanim who typically sit as neutral arbitrators on batei din. We don't view it as you pick your advocate and you pick your advocate and you continue to have conversations with your advocate, and the only real neutral is that third party. We view a zabla in its proper form as a panel of three neutral people. It's just that you have a hand in picking, each side has a hand in picking one of the three arbitrators.
What would you do if you guys are willing to recognize the choice of law, and they are Hasidic, whatever reason, they don't agree to that? So how are you going to pick a third person? They're saying, we will only pick someone who will not recognize the choice of law. Because if we will, that's the contract says the choice of law, we'll acknowledge. So clearly, whoever that third one is, depending on which way he goes, will determine whether they're going to recognize choice of law.
Right. They'll have to try to pick someone who's sort of... There are many rabbinic personalities in our communities that have broad enough appeal that can sort of bridge gaps and try to bridge that gap. Ultimately, you'll end up with an imperfect decision, perhaps, that'll sort of come out of that panel. Zablas are not ideal, for sure, and that's why a contractual clause that names a specific bezdin is ideal, is really the way to go.
Zero, two different bezdins against each other, like that court will say, you're not coming to our bezdin, and you'll send out the other not the bezdin.
No, because ultimately the defendant has the right not to come to the bezdin insisted on by the plaintiff. Whereas if as long as the defendant is willing to go to a legitimate bezdin, we won't issue a seiru. If ultimately they don't cooperate in forming the zabla, we'll issue a heter akos. We'll give permission to the plaintiff to go to secular court, so he has his remedies there.
Can you talk a little bit about the prenuptial agreement? So the last 10 years, there's been a big push by the Dentin of America on the prenuptial agreement. Most of us in this room, I sense, probably don't have a prenuptial agreement because we got married before that big push. Why hasn't there been a similar push on the post-prenuptial agreement? I know it's on your internet site, but there's no dissemination by Dentin of America or the OU or any organization that I know of.
I tell people whenever I speak about the prenup that the postnup makes an excellent anniversary gift.
Also, you've had not so much, but in speaking, often parents will call about the prenup. I don't really understand this. What is going on? And one way to really show your children that it might be the proper thing to do is to execute a postnup at the same time, saying the same way that we want you to respect each other in the case of a dissolution of marriage, we are putting our skin in the game and we're doing the same thing. But you're right, there should be, I think, more of a push and more of an education about the fact that there even is a postnup.
Yeah, I think that the real opportunity to make the prenup or the adoption of the prenup widespread is in getting into the prenup market. In other words, it's at the time immediately prior to the wedding where the couple's faced with this decision, and frankly, you have that leverage. You could say, look, I really want to get married, but we just have to do this as a matter of process. And it's at that point that you have, that the rabbi has the couple's ear and can say, I'm not going to do the wedding unless the prenup is signed. That's really, I think, the ideal opportunity to get it signed. It's a little tougher with a postnup. On an individual basis, you could try to convince people to sign postnups, and I encourage everyone to sign postnups. I think it's really the right thing to do. It's an important, as you said, an important model to show your children. But it's tougher on a community-wide level to sort of make it widespread, like you can do with the prenup, I think.
I have a follow-up to the prenup question. Given that the rabbi has so much leverage at that moment, I'm not going to marry you. A lot of rabbis are saying, I won't marry you unless you sign this. Regarding the enforceability of the prenup, especially with the choice of law clause, what happens if a particular jurisdiction has very clear rules about the enforceability of a prenup if it's done right before the wedding, if neither party is represented by an attorney? How do you ensure that it will be enforceable?
So California is really the biggest issue with that. California has a very tough prenuptial agreement statute. We have a special forum for California because of that. Other states, the prenup statutes are not quite as tough. And general under principles of comity, a court will respect the laws of the state in which the prenup was signed. You know, if you let's say sign a prenup in New Jersey or New York and then get divorced in California, California courts will respect the enforceability of the prenup because it was enforceable in the state in which it was signed.
Would it be wise to train rabbis or to express to rabbis that perhaps it would be better to approach the issue of the prenup maybe more than 30 days before the wedding?
Absolutely.
Or already have representation to ensure that because our honey, when my husband officiates weddings, usually it's for people who are not religious, who chances are won't go to Beis Din, in the future when it comes to the dissolution of their marriage, and it very likely may not be enforceable in that particular jurisdiction because we came from South Carolina. South Carolina was actually pretty strict about the rules in terms of forming, a prenup. So to ensure that these are actually enforceable in civil court too, in the event that parties unfortunately do go to civil court.
I agree. Rabbis should do it more than...
It's also a matter of education. I know Ora has gone into some of the high schools and given programs. I think we're going to try and do that. Particularly, in the girls, to have someone come in and explain what it is. And then separately in the boys' high schools, I think Ora's gone more into the co-ed high schools to show how it's really relevant to both sides and it really is beneficial to both sides. And also, we've made a big push with college teachers to discuss it as much as possible. I don't know how formalized the chasen classes are. It should be pushed. And yes, when someone gets engaged, it should be on the list for whoever to discuss with them.
Just one last note about the prenup. It really, really works. I could tell you in the cases that come to us, it changes the whole dynamic of the conversation about the timing of the get. When there's a prenup, the get is not used as a tool for negotiation leverage. It's really, and I could say with certainty that in 100% of the cases that there's been a prenup, a get has been given, there's been no long-term aguna situation. So it really, really is an effective tool. Really it is.
A question over here. With respect to commercial arbitration, will the Fed then ever order discovery before the proceeding? If not, why not?
Yes, we do sometimes. The rules and procedures provide for pre-hearing conferences where we can either with the administrative staff of Bethman, either Alana or myself, will get on the phone with the attorneys and work out a discovery schedule. Or in some cases, depending on the dynamics of the case with the Dayanim, we might even have a hearing where we talk about discovery process. So it's certainly a possibility. Although the Beis Din sometimes will caution the parties against over-discovering. In other words, sometimes one of the benefits of arbitration is the speed of the arbitration and the relative informality. And if you can get to a case that's not too complex without too much discovery, sometimes that's beneficial for everyone. Obviously, if there's facts out there that need to be discovered, discovery is a necessary component, and we'll go down that path.
I'll ask a question myself, which is, in child custody cases, what role does the religious observance level of the parents play in the decision?
I'll tell you that ultimately the standard utilized by the Beis Din is the best interests of the children. That's consistent with the standards used by the courts. Sometimes religious lifestyle will be relevant to that. For example, if you have a couple that's been observant and raised their kids observant their whole lives, and then one of the spouses becomes non-religious, the best interest of the children might depend on being with a family, retaining the stability of their upbringing, staying in yeshiva, having Shabbos with the observant parent. You wouldn't want to disturb that. But that's not much different than the way the courts would attack it. I can tell you the flip side is also true. If you have a non-observant family where the kids have been in public school their whole lives, and then all of a sudden the father does tshuva and becomes a satmar chassid, it's probably not in the best interest of the children to just be sent to the father for Shabbos.
When we're dealing with end-of-marriage issues where minors are involved, we usually will have a mental health professional.
Almost always.
Well, basically, unless we're dealing with adult children. But minor children, we'll have a mental health professional sit on the panel as one of the Dayanim because while Rabbanim are wonderful and great, there are certainly things that might be outside of their expertise. And so we really look to the leading mental health professionals in our community to sit for us.
We all know that going to court, secular court, is pretty expensive when it comes to paying the lawyers. You have to admit that. But what is the cost of going to Fesden, and how does that split up among the two parties?
If we're dealing with one Dayan, and let me just step back. Unless we're dealing with a very complex commercial case, we do feel that a party doesn't necessarily need an attorney. If you have a contractor or like your plumber, you don't necessarily need an attorney in such a case. Again, we're putting complex issues of secular law aside. So you're going to be paying the Beis Din fees only without an attorney, and most show up without an attorney. So if you're dealing with one Dayan, it's $150 per hour per side. And if you're dealing with three Dayanim, it's $300 per hour per side.
And maybe we have one more question. Should we?
One more.
Thank you.
In a case where, in a commercial situation, contract enforcement with has been a choice of law, and one of the parties feels that the arbitration panel, and this applies to the second arbitration period as well, I guess, have made manifest error in the application of the law, clearly overlooks not even a subtle point, wants to go to court to challenge that. I think generally they can't. At least the contract will often say that. And it's a form of appeal from the arbitration situation. Now, if the second choice of law is halacha, what recourse might a plaintiff have? There is no formal system of appeal invested, right?
I'm sorry. You're saying that there was an arbitration decision that somehow there was a mistake in application?
If there was state law, state law would apply, generally the court of that state might well reconsider the application of that state's law by the arbitration panel. Let's take that as an assumption. Some of us are all depends on
the
law. And also, they're not going to open up their fashion dishpot to see whether the Beis Din applied correctly. But what recourse would a party have? It may be in the...
Section 31 of the Rules and Procedures of the Beis Din America contains a provision that's unique among Batei Din. It allows for modification of an award if a party makes an application within 20 days after the delivery of the award alleging a mistake of Jewish law. It then gets reviewed by the Av Beis Din or another Dayan delegated by the Av Beis Din, who will accept submissions by the parties challenging the validity of the decision and can revisit, either remand it back to the original panel or change it, whatever it is, the Av Beis Din or his delegee determines how to do that. That's a provision that's unique to the Beth Din of America, and it's an important provision because it allows us to take a second look if there's a manifest error. We try to avoid manifest error, but at least we have that additional safeguard built in.
Okay, I want to thank everyone for coming. Sorry we couldn't get to all the questions.